Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, arms talks are going well in Copenhagen, even if climate talks aren't. President Obama announced that his meetings today with Russia's president have edged the two countries closer to a new arms control agreement. But world leaders are scrambling to find common ground on climate control. Earlier today, President Obama addressed the delegation.
We are running short on time. And at this point, the question is whether we will move forward together or split apart, whether we prefer posturing to action.
Obama went on to warn world leaders what would happen if they didn't get a legally binding treaty out of these two-week talks.
We will be back having the same stale arguments month after month, year after year, perhaps decade after decade, all while the danger of climate change grows until it is irreversible.
Joining us from Copenhagen is Matt McGraw, the BBC's science correspondent. Matt, what's your sense of President Obama's tone today?
President Obama's tone struck me as quite terse, actually. It was very businesslike, very sober. His schedule went a little bit out the window this morning. He was due to come here and give a speech early on. He didn't turn up for about an hour. We understand he was having a meeting with a group of about 20 other leaders from the developed world and from the developing world to try and move things forward here. His speech and his tone, as I said, were terse, quite sober. He very businesslike. Some people said he was giving a take it or leave it speech. This is my way or the highway kind of thing. He outlined what he thought could do. He was very clear that failure was an option and things could go wrong here. But he was also saying that we could do this today, and it's that element of today. This is right down to the wire here. The leaders are here right now. How long they will stay, we don't know. But they have this opportunity. It's very difficult to get 120 global leaders in one place at one time. To get them here right now working on a text without some sort of deadline, it means they're really working very, very hard to try and move this forward in the hours that they've left, because technically this summit's supposed to end in a very short period of time. So, you know, they're really trying to drive that forward now.
Well, President Obama isn't the only world leader maybe flexing some muscle. He did meet privately with the Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao, but Wen did not attend closed-door meetings today. We understand that did not go over well with U.S. officials.
Yeah, the big issue appearing between the United States and the Chinese is this issue of what the Americans call transparency, what in the other terms is called verification. Hillary Clinton made a speech yesterday offering that the United States would take part in a global fund of $100 billion from 2020 to help adaptation in countries which were suffering from climate change. Conditional on that was an agreement here in which countries like India and China would take on measurable, reportable and verifiable emissions reductions actions. That is, that they would cut their emissions of greenhouse gases and that would be somehow provable in the international stage. That's very important for President Obama to be able to bring that back to America. They didn't have that with Kyoto. They didn't have anything like that. He can't bring back a treaty or an agreement from here without some element of that. That's proving to be a real sticking point. Other leaders have said that this issue of MRV, as it's called in the technicalities, transparency, is a real difficult one to get past.
Well, and of course then, we've been hearing all week, the sharp divisions between advanced and developing nations very much flexing their muscles. So how is that negotiating going?
Yes, I mean, there's a classical division here in these UN processes between the rich and the poorer countries, the developed world and the developing world, and that's manifested itself time and again here, and it's led to lots of procedural wrangles and procedural debates. That was manifest very much today when we had the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, giving a very fiery speech, which he was criticizing President Obama as the emperor who came in the middle of the night and cooked up a document, but we'll never accept it. And he said there was a smell of sulfur around the place after President Obama, all very colourful language, and reiterating, you know, some of the divisions that are in the place. But the main leaders who are trying to drive this forward are both from the developed and the developing world. They are trying to find and negotiate a middle path forward. But there are some crucial hurdles when it comes to putting numbers down on paper, when it comes to coming up with an international agreement that may not be legally binding as yet, but will form the basis of a legally binding agreement. So this is where it becomes really, really difficult. And this is where those traditional divisions come up again and again.
It's funny. You just mentioned the smell of sulfur comment. It's one that Hugo Chavez made about President Bush at another point in history. That's the BBC science correspondent Matt McGraw speaking to us from Copenhagen, where things don't seem to be going all that well, just to sum up. Matt, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Wally Lamb's last best-selling novel, The Hour I First Believed, had at its center the terrible school massacre at Columbine. But his new book is a breezy holiday read which evokes former radio great Gene Shepherd's wonderful Christmas stories. At the climax of Wally's book, a school Christmas pageant gone hilariously wrong at St. Aloysius Gonzaga Parochial School in 1964.
At first, the audience was stunned to silence as it stared upon what, I'm guessing, was the most bizarre nativity they'd ever seen. For there before them, below the electrified star of Bethlehem, was a baby Jesus with shrunken feet, a bent-at-the-waist Joseph, and not one but two Marys, one of whom seemed to be wearing a goatee.
That baby Jesus is half fifth grader, half baby doll, and Joseph, well, let's just say he's bent over because of a problem below the waist. Wally Lamb's new book is called Wishin' and Hopin' a Christmas Story, the title an homage to the great Dusty Springfield, who's on the jukebox soundtrack that runs through the printed pages. The cast of characters includes Annette Funicello, yes, the former Mouseketeer, stern Catholic school teachers, an exotic French substitute, and of course, the storyteller Felix Funicello, the littlest fifth grader who looks like Dondi, the Italian war orphan in the comic strips. Felix has an uncontrollable urge to French kiss his cousin Annette on the poster that hangs above his father's friolator in the diner Dad runs at the local bus stop. Wally Lamb joins us in the studio. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Hey, Robin. Good to be here.
What fun. Was this a way to sort of mentally floss away the tough subject matter from your last book?
Yeah. You know, The Hour I First Believed took me about 10 years to write. And then when I finished it, I was off and running on a 26-city book tour. Mm-hmm. I remember one of the toughest cities was a suburb of Denver, where a lot of the Columbine people had been. And I even met one of the fathers of the killers. So, yeah, I needed to sort of remind myself through my work that as hard as life can be, it can also be funny and the sun can shine as well.
Right. And it's not as if 1964 is an all sunshine year. It was the year after so many assassinations in this country.
That's right. And then the civil rights battle was being waged and Vietnam was just about brewing
right.
as well.
So. But still, we're with a fifth grader who doesn't yet grasp so many things. And I'm just wondering, is this book also a way to maybe rewrite that year? I couldn't help but notice the dedication reads, "For Chris, a happier 1964.
Yeah. Chris is my wife, Christine. That was the year that her father died. He was only in his 30s, and he left five children. My wife was the oldest and four younger brothers. And that had come right on the heels of President Kennedy's assassination. So, yeah, I wanted to make her laugh about the year 1964 as well.
Well, and you did that to us. We laughed quite a bit. I thought it was at first a memoir, but you say you came up with this main character, Felix Funicello. Poor Felix, the 10-year-old, first. So how did you come up with him? He's not you.
Maybe if you can quantify this kind of thing, I think he's about maybe 50% me. He's an Italian-American. His parents are working class. He has two older sisters that he loves to bother.
Is that you?
That's me.
Yeah.
But Felix is a little bit more impish than I ever was. And he started because of a coincidence. The editor of HarperCollins called up and said, "Hey, you know, Wally, why don't you try writing a Christmas book?" And my immediate reaction was, "Nah, that's too corny. I'm not going to do that." And then later on that same day, a friend of mine said, "You know, you write these brooding, dark novels, and they're not you. Why don't you try a Christmas book?" And again, I rejected the idea. But then shortly after that, I was cleaning my desk, and I keep a file of interesting character names. And the name Felix popped out on an index card. And I just started playing a word game, alliteration. And I don't know why Annette Funicello popped into my mind, but when I fused...
Well, maybe because you were once a teenage boy.
That could be it.
So she became the distant cousin of Felix.
Right, third cousin. And the Funicello family on the East Coast is very excited because Annette on the West Coast is quite famous. And at this point, she's moved beyond the Mouseketeer years, and she's starring in all those sort of cheesy beach party movies with Frankie Avalon.
Now, Dee Dee, come
I have just one question. Did you kiss him because he's lovable or because he's the only man on the beach?
Oh, no, don't quit now, Dee Dee. I think you're ahead.
Okay, how's this for a closer?
So I fused the name Felix with the surname Funicello, and bam, I was off to the races.
But now, had you gone to Catholic school?
I did not. A lot of people are sort of surprised when I say that, but I was raised a Catholic, and I went to catechism class every Wednesday. So I had a once-a-week taste of the nuns at St. Patrick's School.
Well, where did you get the other things that people tell me are, you know, absolutely spot on, you know, the nuns on the verge of a nervous breakdown? And
well, you know where that stuff comes from is whenever you mention parochial school, people who went roll out the stories nonstop, and a lot of them are just hilarious. Some of them are a little horrifying as well. But yeah, I find that people want to talk about their experiences and remember things.
Well, in fact, you're in a writer's group, and your writer's group met regularly at a luncheonette where you took some of the information there to shape Felix Funicello's family luncheonette. And you talked there to people who were in Catholic school. What are some of the little details they gave you?
Oh, gosh. Things like the kids used to be ranked academically and then seated accordingly. So the smart kids sat up in the orchestra seats, if you will. And, you know, the dumber you were, the further back you sat. And so that, you know, the kids who had stayed back a couple of times, they were back by the clanging radiators at the, in the windows.
Right. Other things. Because it's such a part of the book, the Catholic school.
Well, something that's in the book, there is a sort of a real spicy new student who comes in, Zenya Kabakova, who is a transfer from, of all places, the Soviet Union. And when she's caught kissing one of Felix's friends, Lonnie, the nuns have a special meeting out on the fire escape. And they are told that if girls provide the occasion for sin of a boy, then they're probably going to go to hell. And that's a story that I heard.
Also, she has this wonderful accent, having just come from Russia. Give us a taste of her her accent.
At one point, the substitute nun, who everybody is very scared of, Zenya, a perfectly legal act, is to get up out of her chair and go to the pencil sharpener. But, of course, the substitute is having none of it. And so she says, "Young lady, where are you going?" And she says, "I'm going to pencil sharpener. My pencil point is dull."
Wally Lamb, voicing one of the characters in his new book, Wishing and Hoping, A Christmas Story. After the break, we're going to hear about one of the other characters in his book, Annette Funicello. We'll find out why Wally chose to put her in the book, and it has something to do with how she's doing in real life. Later today, questions about that Canadian sports doctor. He's in court today on charges of drug smuggling. But meanwhile, here's more of Dusty Springfield, her music also throughout Wally's book. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Wally Lamb. His new novel is Wishin' and Hopin', A Christmas Story. It's set in 1964 Connecticut. It features a parochial school Christmas pageant where everything that can go wrong does. The main character, 10-year-old fifth grader Felix Funicello, yes, he's related to Annette, the then teen superstar. We'll have more on her in a moment. In the pageant, Felix ends up as the baby Jesus. Wally, this is really a time machine back to the 60s. Felix's family works very hard. They run a luncheonette at the local bus depot. And Felix's mom gets to go to a Pillsbury bake-off. Here's some sound from one of the real events.
Quiet. 100 women at work competing for the nation's highest cooking honors at the famous Pillsbury Grand National Bake-Off.
You had a friend who actually had a mother who did that?
Yeah, one of my oldest friends, Bob Parzik. His mother was a Connecticut representative in 1959. Yeah, I sort of always knew this. It was kind of in the background. But then when I started this book, I said, oh, I wonder what that was like. And Bob had amazing recall of a lot of the details. So I just sat there and took notes. Things like, you know, who knew that Ronald Reagan was the roving reporter at the Pillsbury Bake Off?
As he is here.
Yeah.
Back then, everyone would find a television. Everyone in America would watch it.
Yeah. Oh,
watch your mom, you know, on TV.
Right. And, of course, that's disaster as well in one of the chapters.
Oh, that's right. Mom has the runs.
Yeah.
It's live TV.
Yeah. So. She gets so nervous.
That's right. I forgot about that. Well, and Felix, this child, also makes an appearance on TV. He goes to see the Ranger Andy show, which you did.
Yes. I was a guest on Ranger Andy. It was a local TV station up in Hartford, Connecticut. And I remember how exciting it was. My Cub Scout troop and I trooped onto the bus and drove up to the big city of Hartford. And Ranger Andy sort of gives you your cue, you know, who's that coming down the trail? And we all clomp out. Now, the funny thing, this is an urban legend. Felix tells a dirty joke, you know, unknowingly.
How should we say this? It's something to do with a meatloaf in an oven and a woman or something.
Well, the question is, how is a woman like a stove?
Yeah.
And I think maybe we'll skip the
answer
to that.
Yeah, just fine. Keep going. And he blurts it out.
He blurts it out. Now, I never told that joke on the air, but that joke supposedly was told, and it shut down the Ranger Andy show for about a week.
Oh, you know, it's so timely. It's sort of shades of the late, great Soupy Sales.
Yes.
Who had a wonderful children's show in that same era and was always getting in trouble for things that
right.
he said.
The difference is that Soupy tried to be funny. Ranger Andy was dead serious.
Well, you do a very interesting thing. There's so many other characters. We can't go through them all. There's the stuck-up Rosalie Twersky, Felix's nemesis, you know, the smartest kid in the school, tattles on everyone, writes her own Christmas pageant. Give us one of the highlights of her Christmas pageant, by the way.
Oh, gee, well, it's titled Jesus is the Reason for the Season. And it's the sort of play that you would expect a goody-goody girl to write.
She brings posters to class for extra credit. One reads, Mortal Sinners, Burning in Hell or Headed There?
Yeah.
Lonnie Flood is Felix's friend. He's been held back a couple of times, sort of a hood, but likable. His father's in prison. You know, it's a kind of a powerful moment there. He doesn't know his father. He thinks his father's away fishing and has sort of, let's say, a physical reaction to the Russian student that he can't control. Hence, when he plays Joseph, he's doubling over.
Well, you know, Felix and his peers are 10 years old, but Lonnie is about 12 and a half. And Xenia, they find out, it's very shocking that she's 13 years old.
Yeah.
So
that's going to happen. And then into the story, and we won't tell how, Wander's cousin, Annette Funicello. Why'd you put her in the story?
I heard somewhere around the time that I was writing it that she's afflicted with multiple sclerosis and is in fairly bad shape with it. And I kind of wanted to blow a kiss to her. You know, she had been such a sweetheart as a mousketeer, and, you know, she just always seemed to me like a very good person. I kind of wanted to write a little bit of a tribute to Annette.
Well, in fact, you have an epilogue, and it tells us what happened to a lot of these characters. Rosalie Twersky, I think, is she the one that goes with Up With People?
Yeah.
Yes. Felix's friend Lonnie relocates to Las Vegas. It turns out the girl from the Soviet Union was actually the niece of the people that Felix thought were her parents. They were defectors.
But also, in this day and age, she has hundreds of Facebook friends.
Right. And then reading this, that's again when I thought, well, is this real? Are these real people? Are you really telling us? And you're not, except when you get to Annette Funicello.
Right, yeah.
And you even tell people how they, you know, maybe couldn't help out with her cause.
Right, uh-huh. There's also a sort of an effort underway to contact her and send her either the audio or the book itself. And hopefully, if she chooses to listen to it or if she can read it, to just get a smile out of it.
Well, and that's so lovely. But it also, I don't know, this might set off alarm bells in our 20-something listeners, 30-something listeners. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is another baby boomer that can't get over the 60s. Nobody had it as great as, you know, when you had Annette Funicello. You know? And this lovely time when the most hilarity you could have would be at the Christmas pageant. And what do you say about that, about the enduring nature of a story like this, at least, you know, in your mind?
Well, for whatever reason, this story was largely fueled by YouTube. When I started to go back myself into the year 1964 and doing some research, I found that all of this old stuff was there, and it was so evocative to me that I ended up making a list of about 12 or 14 links that we actually put on the HarperCollins website. I put those not only for baby boomers to be nostalgic about, but also, you know, for younger readers who might never have heard of Annette Funicello or certainly wouldn't remember when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan for the first time. And so, you know, they can click on those and sort of bring the past back to life.
That's Wally Lamb. His new book is Wishin' and Hopin', A Christmas Story. We'll link you to those YouTube videos at our website, hereandnow.org. Wally, thanks so much.
Oh, I had a great time. Thank you, Robin.
Vacation is here. Beach party tonight.
As we listen to Annette, Monday on Here and Now, former fundamentalist Frank Schaeffer rejects both the Christian right and the new atheists who confront them. He says there's an alternative. He calls it the Church of Hopeful Uncertainty. We'll speak to him on Monday. Still ahead today, what is the relationship between Tiger Woods and Canadian doctor charged with smuggling banned drugs? That's still to come. Latest news is next, Here and Now.
Nothing is greater than the sand serpents out there. Unwrack our boards just as soon as we get there. Stack them in the sand while they're breaking just right. Yeah, we're surfing all day and we're swinging all night. Vacation is here. Beach party tonight.
The governor of Indiana says he has an idea that will save economically devastated towns. Combine them. Take Gary in Lake County, Indiana. It was founded in 1906 when U.S. Steel built a factory there. The Jackson Five grew up there. But now unemployment is high and nearly a quarter of the population lives below the poverty line. And Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels wants the city to consider merging with another one. John Seidel covers Gary, Indiana for the Post Tribune of Northwest Indiana. And John, these comments from the governor come at a rough time for Gary. Tell us some of the cuts they've had to make.
There have been several. They privatized garbage collection, which was actually, believe it or not, a real touchy issue this year. They've consolidated several departments, and overall they've laid off about 300 people.
Had to close the city jail. You mentioned
yes.
They privatized garbage collection. At one point, it just stopped.
Yes, it was subject to some litigation from some citizens who weren't happy with the way that went about. And when an agreement couldn't be reached, the mayor and the sanitary district just shut down the operation for a week.
Well, and Indiana just enacted a property tax cap. Now, Gary managed to appeal that cap for a while and was able to, you know, get slightly higher property taxes. But now there's a chance the cap's going to be voted into the state constitution. So how much is that going to further hurt Gary, Indiana's revenue if they can't get, you know, a slightly higher property tax?
Well, Gary has a state mandated fiscal monitor, which just a few weeks ago made the statement that if the caps go into a full effect in Gary, it will have to cut its budget by about a half, from about $60 million to $30 million. That, they said, would leave only enough money to pay the salaries of police, firefighters, and EMS workers. That would leave nothing left over for benefits for those workers and nothing left over for anything, not for a mayor, not for elected officials, not for any services. That's it.
Well, so what's been the response to the governor's suggestion that Gary merge with somebody?
It's been mixed. I mean, mostly the reaction has been merge with who? I mean, several governments around here are having issues. Gary is just the worst off. Other people just aren't apt to follow any of his suggestions. It's a pretty Democratic area here, and he's a Republican governor. And Lake County, Indiana has traditionally been sort of detached from the rest of the state.
Well, let's put an even finer point on it, as others have. You know, further south, Indianapolis is more consolidated.
Mm-hmm.
What else might be going on in the north where Gary is? Are there racial issues as well?
Absolutely. You know, Northwest Indiana has a long, painful racial history, and the undercurrents are still in play, even in North and South Lake County. North Lake County is predominantly minority population, less so in Southern Lake County. Definitely different approaches to government in the different parts of the counties, and the two definitely butt heads. And South Lake County tends to go more with the rest of the state of Indiana. And there have been a series of pieces of legislation that have been enacted over the last few years that have led some in Gary to believe there's a coordinated effort in Indianapolis to dismantle the city.
Well, and Gary, Indiana is 84% African-American, and in areas to the south, it's more white. So I'm wondering, are there concerns that Gary might be seen to be taken over?
Yeah, and in fact, it was really the first time that I've heard the governor use the word receivership in regards to Gary. Gary's had fiscal problems for a long time, but the reality of these tax caps possibly going into the Constitution, which is not a definite, means that Gary really needs to find some answers really fast.
And meanwhile, what about longtime residents of Gary? I mentioned, you know, the Jackson Five grew up there. What do they say about what's happened to their town, largely because the steel industry employs fewer people there?
Right. I think the long time, the people who remember its heyday, they're just sad. To know what Gary was and to know what it is today, I mean, it was shoulder to shoulder on Broadway, stores everywhere, and now there's hardly any businesses on Broadway. Broadway is like a ghost town. Mm-hmm. And people are just sad to see what happens because Gary has a proud history. Gary was one of the first two cities to elect an African-American mayor. It was built around the steel industry, and I think a lot of people hope that they can get there again somehow.
John Seidel covers Gary, Indiana for the Post Tribune of Northwest Indiana. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, residents will always have this song. It's, of course, from Meredith Willson's The Music Man. We'll listen to a little and be reminded, and then take a break. Be right back in a bit, here and now. There are new questions being raised about Tiger Woods, having nothing to do with his family and everything to do with sports and his association with a celebrity Canadian sports doctor who's in court today in Canada to face charges that he smuggled or tried to smuggle a drug that's banned in sports if used intravenously. Now, Dr. Anthony Galea denies any wrongdoing. He's known for using legal cutting-edge therapies to heal injured muscles, and he says he did use one of those legal therapies, platelet-rich plasma therapy, to treat Tiger Woods at the golfer's home in Florida this year. But Galea doesn't have a license to practice medicine in the U.S. Authorities are also investigating whether he provided performance-enhancing drugs to professional athletes. Christine Brennan is a sports columnist for USA Today and an ABC News commentator. She joins us from Washington. And Christine, let's just really underscore again, be clear. You write there is not a shred of evidence that Tiger Woods used an illegal substance or cheated on the golf course.
That is correct, Robin. And it's important to mention that, of course. This is the steroid era in sports, isn't it? And mm-hmm. Really 21 years since the Ben Johnson saga in Seoul at the Olympics in 88, which I covered, when he was stripped of his gold medal when he tested positive for a steroid, we've been off and running on the story of our lives. You know, it's kind of like follow the money in Watergate, follow the doctors, or follow the sports nutrition gurus in the issue of performance-enhancing drugs. Again, does that mean Tiger's done it? Nope. But I think it's always good to keep following these stories.
Well, one of the questions about Dr. Anthony Galea, the things that were in a bag that he had his assistant try to get across the border from Canada to the U.S., what were some of those things that raised questions for you?
Well, the number one thing is human growth hormone, HGH. It is banned by the PGA Tour. It is banned by the World Anti-Doping Agency, so the Olympics and many other sports. Very few people test for it because it involves a blood test, which is invasive. And why did the doctor have HGH? And he was going to Tiger's house, as you said, and HGH is banned, and it would be a horrible turn of events for Tiger Woods if, I stress if, he were taking HGH. That means he would have cheated on the golf course, which I can't imagine golf ever allowing him back in its good graces if he did that.
Well, after his assistant was stopped at the border and admitted that she'd been told to try to smuggle things into the country for this Dr. Anthony Galea, officials went to his office in Canada and found other banned substances there. One of the other substances that was found is Activegan. This is not approved in the U.S. or Canada. It is legal in parts of Europe. It's made out of calves' blood. It's been shown to get more oxygen to working an injured muscle. What does the World Anti-Doping Agency say about Activegan?
Well, they're still monitoring it, but it's not yet banned. I think this is one of those things for people who, again, trying to make some sense of all this. The bad chemists are way ahead of the good chemists in the world of Olympic sports and the world of golf and other sports as well. Often there's new drugs, designer drugs, and I'm not saying Activegan is that entirely, but it really is something that is still new to many of us who've covered this for years. And that doesn't mean it's not terrible. And my guess is it will be banned soon.
Well, so what we seem to have here is a sports doctor from Canada treating Tiger Woods several times over the course of the past year with a very legal procedure. Tiger's agent says it's widely accepted. Again, this is the platelet-rich plasma therapy. Tiger's agent says it's widely accepted, and to suggest some connection with illegality is recklessly irresponsible. So we have that story just sitting out there, but at the very least, we have a doctor from Canada coming into the U.S. to treat someone with a lot of money who can afford to do this. I mean, I'm assuming there are other questions. If not Tiger Woods, then who?
Right, and then he apparently was treating Dara Torres, the Olympic medalist. She said that he did, I guess, worked on her once on one tendon. There are other people that have been linked to him, professional baseball and football players. So he's kind of the doctor to the stars. And again, there's nothing particularly wrong about that. The whole thing has blown up because of what was in his bag. The therapy itself, as you've said, it's done in a lot of places. One question I would have for Tiger, if he were speaking, would be, why did you need to fly in a doctor from Canada to do this when you probably could have gotten it within a couple miles of your home by an orthopedic surgeon of some kind? That goes right to the heart of why Dr. Galea.
Well, the New York Times might have one answer to that question as to why someone was brought in. Sometimes it's the agents or the handlers who panic when someone's not healing quickly enough.
You know, there's a footprint to all the cheating that we've seen in sports. And it is when they get concerned, an athlete, Ben Johnson, for example, getting ready for the Olympics in Seoul, and he wasn't healing fast enough, and they shot him up with illegal substances too close to the date when he was going to compete, and that's how he got caught. So when I heard the news that IMG, the agent for Tiger, wanted Dr. Galea because they were concerned about Tiger's recovery time, again, I stress, we have no idea what Tiger took or didn't take. But it sure had that same kind of M.O., and that's why, as journalists, if people are sick of the Tiger Woods story, I would say this is a whole different element. This goes right to the wheelhouse of the mainstream media and what we've been covering for 20-some years, a pattern of behavior. We can learn from that. That doesn't mean it ensnares Tiger Woods, but it informs us in a way that we can then report on the story of the biggest athlete in our culture and whether or not he cheated.
Christine Brennan, sports columnist for USA Today and an ABC News commentator. Well, we heard from many of you who also thought, enough of Tiger. Lisa Boven, listening in Anchorage, Alaska, wrote, Tiger Woods, seriously? He's not an elected politician. He's not a church leader. He's a golfer. James Glass of Boise, Idaho, wrote, after our last story with Christine, in which she questioned if Tiger's handlers, famous for withholding access to him, had participated in his downfall. James says, of course he has image handlers. Why not? It's not a crime. And Sherry Bland of Monterey, California wrote, what about good stories about athletes? Well, since you mentioned, I used to know a lot of athletes with good stories. Years ago, believe it or not, I had an agent who was also a sports manager, so I got to watch up close as Larry Bird arrived in Boston in his Oshkosh B'gosh coveralls and then took flight. He married his college sweetheart. Nice people. Quarterback Doug Flutie was just a kid from Boston College before he hit the big time. Now he and his wife have dedicated themselves to autism research. Very nice people. And then there's Bobby Orr. We'd done some reporting together, and once we were part of a charity blue fishing tournament on Martha's Vineyard. We both stayed at the same lovely seaside hotel in Edgartown. One night I thought I'd go for a walk, and Bobby said, I'll join you. Rut-row. We walked down the dark boat ramp to the water, my mind racing. Oh, no, this is Bobby Orr, the gentleman on the ice and off, hockey's golden boy, married to Mrs. Orr. Was he about to come crashing off that pedestal? Was Bobby Orr going to make a different kind of pass? We gazed at the water. Nice night, isn't it? Then turned and walked back to the hotel, where Bobby turned to me and said, now you had me worried. Please tell me you'll never walk alone at night again. Good night. I wish all stories ended that way, but we know they don't.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
And we welcome you back with a song the New York Times called Absolutely Gorgeous. What do you think?
I'm ready to be afraid. I'm ready to jump.
It's called Jump. It's the opening track on Blazing Red, a CD from singer-songwriter Ann Heaton, who visited us back in March just after Blazing Red was released. Since then, Ann's career has been on an upswing. She's been touring almost nonstop, so we thought we'd reprise our conversation with her, which began with her thoughts on having a song like Jump in the Zeitgeist, one critics call gorgeous.
It feels good. I even like to listen to it.
You even like to listen to it?
I do, even though it's mine.
A rave review for your own music, if you can stand to listen to it. But what does it mean for you, by the way?
Well, this album is a lot about making transitions or changes, sometimes foundational changes. And in Jump, I did use some personal experience, but I tried to broaden it so that people could find themselves in the music as well.
Talk about you. You've gone from classical to gospel to jazz with Max Roach. We want to talk about that. Started taking piano lessons when you were just three. You were trained in classical music and awarded a scholarship, at least a part scholarship, to the Berklee College of Music here in Boston. But we understand you turned that down. Why?
I did. The scholarship was contingent upon me continuing to play classical piano. And at that point, I knew I wanted to be a songwriter and approach the piano in a new, simpler way.
And so you didn't want to just be a pigeonhole in classical music.
Right. I didn't think it would be worth it. And they have great songwriting classes there, but yeah. I didn't want to.
Well, and you still, you know, retain the right to put classical, at least sounding things on your CD. There's a minute snippet of music. Let's just listen. This is Strings OV. Now, what's this doing on the CD?
This actually is the result of a mistake, a beautiful mistake. This was a string arrangement that went under the song Pieces of Me, and I kept hearing it and something sounded wrong with the melody. So we kept soloing it in the studio. I was like, I don't think that note's in the chord. It sounds really weird. But because we kept soloing it, which means you just hear the strings, I realized it was so beautiful on its own that I thought, well, we have to take it out of the song, but let's keep it on the record.
So, continue your story. You leave the piano for a while, go to singing and songwriting, and then had what you describe as an epiphany when you joined the choir at Grace Congregational Church in Harlem. Well, tell us about that.
That was an amazing experience. I was taking a few music classes at City College, and I met a choir director who invited me to come sing in this gospel choir. And I just learned all this music that I had not known before, like Motherless Child or Wade in the Water, early American music and gospel music.
This is quite a popular church, too, we should say. I mean, some people go on tours to this church. It's got a beautiful choir.
They have an amazing choir, yeah. John Motley is the choir director there. And then he actually was a friend of Max Roach's, which is how I ended up taking that tour.
Ah, and so now you're touring with drumming legend Max Roach. This is in the 90s, touring through Europe. What was that like, by the way?
It was incredible. I learned a lot from Max because he was so calm. There was always a lot of activity and were we going to learn the music in time? And it sort of seemed like we weren't, you know? But it seemed like he just trusted everybody. And I think that because he trusted everybody, he got the best musicianship.
Are we hearing a little of his influence on You Are My Only Way Out Is In? Or is that just a percussive song?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, it was a segue.
So. Yeah, I know. I'm like, I don't know how to answer that one. That's my version of the blues, but I don't know where it came from.
Let my heart be as big.
Yeah. open about a lot of personal things on this record, even though you said you masked them a little bit. You're 36 years old. Another song on the CD is called Mama to You. You're not expecting. You're expecting to be expecting in a future time.
That's a great way of putting that. I'm not yet a mom, but I would like to be a mom at some point. You know, there was a period of time when I stopped doing the writing in the morning, like the morning pages, and I thought I wanted to try something a little different that I wasn't, quote-unquote, supposed to be good at. So I was drawing with crayons in the morning just to sort of open myself up. And one morning, I wasn't really paying attention, but when I looked down, I had drawn myself pregnant, and I thought, oh, wow, you know, I wonder what that means.
People talk about motherhood and the love of motherhood, but people rarely talk about fears, you know, of motherhood. I mean, and this is so honest. Let's listen.
Could you wait a little bit longer? Every day I get stronger. I heal those hurts deep inside. I make room so I can make a life. So I can be mama.
So honest.
Yeah, and just the idea of healing yourself before you bring another life into the world, or learning how to love yourself. You know, like the airplane, put the mask on yourself first before you put it on your child.
That's right. That's singer-songwriter Ann Heaton. Her new CD is Blazing Red. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Ann, so many pretty tunes on the CD. Do you mind? We want to hear more of Jump, which we started with.
No problem.
Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Ann Heaton in a conversation we had back in March of this year. By the way, tonight she'll be performing at the Tin Angel in Philadelphia, playing new and traditional holiday songs with the group Winterblume. And we'll leave you with their arrangement of Silent Night. It's sung in German.
Stille Nacht, heilige Nacht, hörten es,
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please have a lovely weekend and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.